So let's begin by opening up our discussion and take questions and comments that are ongoing. Previous classes of readings.
I wasn't here last week, but something came up in the study group this morning about a couple of concepts in Whitehead that I'd like to go over a little bit. I'm thinking particularly about actual occasions, and there being different grades of actual occasions.
Yes.
So, what's the... suddenly I'm clicking into my job as a software writer where they have features and benefits, okay? So, you know, what's the benefit of having a distinction between low, medium, and high grade occasions? That's one of the questions. Why does that come to mind as a useful thing to
say? Anybody have an idea about that? Anybody would like to take a stab at that? Why is it useful to have actual occasions come in a variety of grades? What's the benefit of that from a philosophical point of view?
Well, they are hierarchically different. They are different as for the hierarchical position and for the content.
I'm sorry, I still can't hear you.
They are different as for the hierarchical position. In the structure of universe. So it is necessary to distinguish. Without this, anything would be anything.
Well, but what is this hierarchy that we're talking about, right? So what are the properties or the features of this hierarchy that make it interesting? Why do we need that?
Well, because the higher stage determines the lower stage. The lower stage is dependent on the higher stage it participates. All of its features, all of its traits, all of its qualities are depending on the qualities of the high one.
Well, just answer your question, Richard. Do you want to add?
Well, I understand that as a general principle, but is there something about... Let me ask it this way. What's unique about a high-grade actual occasion? What's unique about it? What makes it importantly different from a low-grade one, other than like a position in a hierarchy? What are things about its nature?
Well, it seems to me that it's a spectrum, low to high, of including more of the mental pole and the ability to bring in thought and consciousness, as opposed to the low-grade that are just causal.
Right.
So it seems to me like a really important classification, just to make it easier to talk about things and see the differences between different occasions in that way, without having each time to describe all the properties of it.
Okay. Now my second related question.
Wait, I'm not satisfied with this question. Yeah. Okay. So let me add a little bit to that. I mean, you guys, Christian, you want to say something?
Well, I was thinking, doesn't it sort of describe a different level of different levels of creativity amongst actual occasions, insofar as higher grade levels of actual occasions have a wider range of potentials in
which
to actualize?
That's all right. Now you guys, it's all good, and everything you guys have said is good. Let me add a little bit to what you said. Okay, so first of all, it is an ideal of metaphysics. Metaphysics, remember, is an activity of explanation. And it's an ideal of metaphysics that it should construe the universe as consisting of one type of finite actuality. And now, way to look at that. One reason for that is because, for example, modern science defines the universe as consisting of a variety of particles. Let's say at the deepest level there are some number, you know, Bill, of subatomic particles they're now got in the zoo. Now, whatever the number is, 23, 36, sort of like the Buddhist dharmas are always changing in number, but there's a certain finite number of entities, and there are different kinds of interactions between them, the strong nuclear interaction, the weak nuclear, electromagnetic and gravitational, different kinds of interaction, right? And so we can look at that, that's kind of interesting. But look, every single one of those particles has something in common, i.e., it's a particle. And every single one of the different causal relations between them has something in common, that is a causal relation. So we can ask this question, what is the very simplest type of particle? What is it? Just event? It's momentary, right? So what is it about all events that they share in common by virtue of being events? So if the whole universe is now seen as one type of entity, it's all events. This is a huge gain in understanding, right? Because it lets us now think through the universe, making the same move over and over again. That is, seeing actual occasions and their interactions everywhere we look. It's a nice move. I mean, science does this with atoms, let's say, or whatever atoms or quarks or whatever the fundamental units are. So it's everywhere you look, you're seeing these fundamental units built up in combinations. And that's what gives us a sense of understanding the universe scientifically. I'm saying, let's stay within that tradition, but let's replace events, like subatomic events, with actual occasions. Okay, so now one reason we have this actual occasion idea is because it lets us say everything actual shares in common certain features by virtue of being an actual occasion. However, once we say that, we then have to account for the difference between the actual occasion, that is my experience in this last eighth of a second, and the actual occasion, that is the experience of one of my nerve cells, or one of the molecules in my nerve cells, or one of the atoms in the molecules, and so forth, right? So if everything is going to be an actual occasion, since that's part of our metaphysical ideal of explanation, then the actual occasions have to differ among themselves to account for the different evolutionary grades that we see, right? So in science, they say everything is made of something like atoms. I'm using that as shorthand. You all understand that, right? Everything is made of atoms, and as we move up on the evolutionary scale, we get more and more complex concatenations of atoms. This is the scientific view, right? Well, the process view is that as we look at nature, we see higher and higher grades of actual occasions. Now, the thing that actual occasions can do that atoms, for example, can't do is that actual occasions can preside over systems of other actual occasions, which is to say an actual occasion of high grade can become embodied in a system of actual occasions of low grade. So this means, for example, if we're looking at a cell, we see that every atom in that cell is a society, personally ordered society, a personality of actual occasions, and every molecule is a complex society of actual occasions, and these are all inorganic, but then they all start working together in this sublimely complex way we call cellular autopoiesis. But the amazing thing then is that the cell acts as if it has its own center of consciousness, and as if the cellular consciousness can apprehend the world in ways that no macromolecule ever could. Now, scientific reasoning does not give us any way of speaking about the central intelligence of the cell, or the central intelligence of a human being, for that matter. But if we use actual occasions, and we hypothesize that actual occasions come in different grades, we now have a way of describing the cell, which is that it's a dissipated structure, system of macromolecules in which a higher grade actual occasion has become embodied. Right, and so now the kind of central self that we experience can be extended to cells, right, and to atoms and so forth. And so we have a way of thinking through in a linear fashion all the different grades of biological complexity that constitute the evolutionary spectrum, all in terms of a single explanatory notion, that is the notion of actual occasions. Does that help?
Yeah, and that leads me to the next question.
Yeah.
Can I just ask one?
Yeah, go.
So are there further grades of occasions as you go up towards supermind?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So there's higher grade actual occasions and higher grade actual occasions. I mean, in other words,
yeah, with mental occasions.
There's a distinction among different types or levels of higher grade actual occasions?
Yes.
Okay.
Basically, we can more or less, I mean, we have to think this through more carefully, but mm-hmm. I would like to make a gesture in the direction of suggesting that it's actual occasions all the way up. So the whole universe itself would be presided over by an actual occasion in some sense, although it would be a different type.
So low, medium, and high are just real gross generalizations.
Very gross, and they basically apply to the actual occasions that are most prominently involved in waking life. Right? So in this class, now at another time, perhaps when we do the Sri Aurobindo class, I will show how it's possible to derive actual occasions from Satchidananda. Right? So we can actually start with the non-dual background and arrive in this interesting way at the notion of actual occasions. Right? So we can actually see, intellectually at least, how each actual occasion is an individualization of God. But I'm not working that territory here. Right? I'm working from the bottom up here. And so I'm just talking about mental, living, and physical actual occasions, sticking closer to the territory of science here.
Okay. So my second question...
Well, hold on, you have a question about that.
Oh, sorry.
Did Whitehead say that a higher grade occasion can embody in a lower grade, or is that part
No,
of
the, that's okay. mine. That's what I've worked out. Whitehead was very vague about the relationship between the presiding actual occasions in a body, for example, and the other members of the body. He just hadn't really thought it through as thoroughly as I think he needed to. And so I thought it through in a different way and come up with this idea of embodiment that I'll be explaining to you.
So am I a persistent series of high-grade actual occasions?
That's what a personality is.
Okay, so an actual occasion just occurs.
That's right.
And then another actual occasion occurs.
That's right.
And there's a persistence, and that's, did you say society?
It's a personally ordered society.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
In other words, a society such that there's one at a time.
And so is the society, as a technical term, is it referring to that serial persistence?
Yes.
Okay.
In other words, a society of actual occasions is a nexus of actual occasions so configured that what it does in one moment continues to its doing the same thing in the next moment.
Okay.
Right? It's sort of a self-perpetuating set of circumstances. And so a personality, in that sense, is a society in which each member creates the conditions to make the next member possible.
Okay. And then you mentioned the term nexus. I'm trying to get at this from a few angles to help clarify it for myself.
Wonderful.
Okay. So if a society is the serially persistent...
No, that's one kind of society. That's a personally ordered
right,
society.
Right, but in this, keeping to the example of
right.
a person now,
right.
as a high-grade actual occasion,
right.
and as a series of those...
That's
yeah.
right.
What's the relationship between the high-grade actual occasion and the lower-grade actual occasions that are kind of like... with it? Are
yeah.
they?
This is a topic that we're going to cover very thoroughly in Chapter 7.
Okay.
It's an excellent question.
Okay.
All the questions you're asking are excellent. That question was one that I spent a great deal of time on, and we'll see how I answer
okay,
it.
Okay, great.
And you can see if you like that or not, you may have criticisms. Wait, did you have something you want to say, Caleb?
I was just asking about Adam. The problem with atoms is you don't get higher and lower grade atoms.
Well, no. For example, I don't think that's true. For example, I would suspect that as you go up the periodic table, you're getting higher grade atoms.
Oh, okay. And you have also higher and lower grade relationship of atoms to each other. Like
well, that's
molecules.
An interesting question. I never thought about applying the notion of grade to relations. But it might work. I have to think about it a little more. But for example, we know that most of the relations between inorganic occasions can be expressed mathematically, which means they're fairly simple. The relations are fairly simple, right? Whereas the relations between living beings are much more complex and almost impossible to express in any mathematical or logical form. So the actual, you're right, in some sense, I hadn't thought of this, that as you get higher grade occasions, you get more elaborate and richer patterns of interaction among them. Good point. Nice. Thank you. Yeah. Bill.
In the business of persistence of a series, or I
yes.
think it would have to be a feedback loop.
What do you mean a feedback
loop? A series of occasions, right, where one stage in the, it's a cycle of occasions where one stage in the cycle, all stages get repeated, or some occasions restore the,
Well, I've been, again, this is something I pay a lot of attention to, particularly in chapter 11.
That's not the core of my question.
But what is your question?
We could skip the feedback loop issues. But so if there's something persistent about a society, doesn't that mean there's a form ingressed in there?
That's correct. That's what stays the same, is the form that's ingressed. That's like, for example, these glasses, right? The event making up these glasses is never the same twice.
Right.
Right? Different temperatures, different gravitational stresses, all kinds of stuff, right? And yet, the form of the glasses remains the same through the sequence of events,
right.
which is a lot of what makes it a society, is that it sustains the ingression of a uniform form throughout a sequence of events. And then, of course, the sameness is more or less.
Right. Right. And when you say form, do you mean as in an eternal object?
Yes, I do. You mean exactly in that sense. Yes. I'm using that word technically in this context. Mm-hmm. Good. These are all great questions. Excellent questions. Do you want to say something? You already said it. Okay. That's great. I really appreciate those questions. Anything else along that line? Yeah, Michael.
I'm still a little bit confused about how time works into this, only because I think that I don't see how the duality is resolved between process and substance, or between change and the thing that changes.
Well, in modern thought, what doesn't change is the substance.
Yes.
Right? So the unchanging element is actual. In process thought, the unchanging element is abstract. It's the form, not the substance. Right? So what remains the same is always forms, but there is no substance that endures unchanged. What there is successive processes of choosing form. That's what there is. So instead of substance, we have the activity of choosing form, which happens and is done, and happens and is done.
But that basic process is then substantialized then.
Well, for example, Whitehead says that creativity, in his system, replaces substance in Aristotle's system.
Creativity replacing the created? Is that the what he's setting up there?
No, see, in Aristotle, the unchanging basis of things is stuff-like.
Yeah.
For Whitehead, the unchanging character of things is ideal-like.
Yeah.
Right. So creativity is the process through which the many become one and are increased by one. Creativity is the process through which a new actual occasion comes into being, takes in the actual world, reduces it to the unity of a new experience, and so becomes an object for future occasions. Right? And so there is no substance here at all. There's just a process, an ongoing recursive process of decision making. Right? And so nothing is there that's a substance. No actual thing endures through time. Only ideas endure through time.
It seems like that means that time only makes sense in the world of ideas, and I think that's what's...
No, why do you say that? Time makes sense in the world of ideas. Time, in fact, time...
Time and sequential time, I'm talking about
that. Yes, that's what it was. Sequential time. Yeah. Sequential time is a relationship between actual occasions. Mm-hmm. But each actual occasion is a moment of time.
Yeah.
It's a duration, right? In other words, for an actual occasion to exist, it must be in time, because it is a process and not a thing, right? And so creativity is the matrix of temporality, right? Out of this creativity, this recursive condition of unifying the many to become one and increase the many by one, right? This process is the expression of time, right? Creativity is the basis of temporality. Right? And so temporality is expressed as the formation of events. And each actual occasion is totally permeated by creativity, which is this assembling process, assembling and deciding process. Right?
I see where it's going, but something still isn't right to me.
And what can you be more articulate about what that is? I'd love to.
I think you've been suggesting that, or referring to this explanation of how the non-dual becomes the dual, or
yeah.
how particularity yeah. comes into being. And
yeah.
I think that's what I'm needing here. Because otherwise it seems like it's no different to say unchanging substance than to say complete change or complete process.
But wait a minute, I never said that, you see. I never said complete process. That is, process is unintelligible
yeah.
apart from a reference to unchanging forms.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
So they need each other. Those
they need each other. Absolutely, they need each other.
But then how do we understand them as simultaneous as opposed to constantly switching back, saying the process is the background, the form is the foreground, or the form is the background and the process is the foreground.
Why do you have to do either one?
I think we need to do both at the same time.
I agree. That makes more sense. I mean, the point is that in order to understand the actual world that we live in, the suggestion is that we need both unchanging eternal objects and fluent processes. In fact, in a certain way, one of the fundamental tasks of metaphysics is the reconciliation of the unchanging and the changing.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So I agree with you, right? And so I'm just suggesting that, for example, in a substantialist model, what isn't changing is sort of out there and actual.
Uh-huh.
But I'm saying we know for sure that nothing actual endures. Mm-hmm. Right? And so therefore, what does endure, and what endures is the ideas, the forms, the eternal objects that are ingressed in a constantly changing series of events. Right.
So what part of endurance isn't an abstraction?
Endurance isn't an abstraction.
What part of endurance is concrete?
Well, for example, I am a personally ordered society, which is concrete.
Right.
Now, in order for me to remain more or less sufficiently the same moment to moment, a lot of my characteristics have to endure. Right, so that's what's enduring. What's enduring is the characteristics, not the substance. Because the substance is always new. Right? So this way we bring freedom back into the whole situation, right? Because the substance is constantly choosing which forms will characterize it. So this is where freedom enters into the creative advance. Now, the point is, look, there are other metaphysical approaches, of course, right? So we can agree to that you know, it seems quite evident that to think through our experience in any kind of philosophical way, we have to deal with the great polarities, and one of them is the changing and the unchanging. So Whitehead gives us an approach to that, a way to do it. I like his way because I'm getting a lot of mileage out of it. And so my invitation to you is to accept his way provisionally
yeah.
to see what it can let you explain, but not to release your doubts about it.
No, that's the contention I'm having is I'm in love with the idea. I sort of arrived at process as being foundational also, but
right.
then it seemed like I was performing the same sort of movement or reductionism that substantialists perform.
Because.
So and now I'm trying to figure out where, and I think this is what Whitehead was saying, because he says at once, an actual occasion is the choosing and the feeling at once.
Yeah.
So I'm really trying to understand how we understand that. What is that? How we situate ourselves in that phenomenologically? How does this actually happen at once? Is that...
Well, that's what the whole thing is about, right? We're trying to talk about the process of concrescence. When we get to chapter 6, we'll go through the whole process of concrescence in much more detail.
Mm-hmm.
And see, one of the frustrations I'm having, and you're probably having, is that we're doing a lot of groundwork here.
Yeah.
Right? And we haven't really gotten to the payoff. The payoff starts coming around chapter 7. That's when all the payoff comes, right? But the reason we're going through it this way is a very important reason, which is that in 30 years of trying, it became completely clear to me that given the framework of ideas through which we interpret the world in modern times, the basic scientific ideas about reality, given that, there simply is no way to talk intelligibly about the transphysical worlds. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not possible. The language we use lacks the metaphysical resources to tackle the problem. Right? So this is an interesting idea, right? Just what I just said is that I've often had the experience of trying to answer a philosophical question and launching in and discovering I simply don't have the tools that I need to do it. Right? And so then at that point you've either got to develop your own tools or you've got to find somebody who's got them. Right? So with me, for example, I came to CIS with the full intention of examining the transphysical worlds. That was my whole project coming here. And I was coming from Aurobindo, and I discovered that Aurobindo simply didn't have the conceptual resources I needed. And I was dead in the water, right? So I was planning on picking up Copleston and going back to the beginning of Western philosophy, looking for ideas I could use. But then Brian introduced me to Whitehead, and there it was. There was the tools that I needed. So I thought, well, I get into that. So I'm talking about developing tools. Yes, we haven't got some of the tools to answer some of these questions yet. We're developing the tools. What we're doing now is developing the tools that we will need to be able to speak intelligently about the transphysical worlds. So we're developing a whole new philosophy of science, a whole new way of understanding the actual world, in terms of which we'll be able to understand both science and the transphysical. But I really appreciate your patience, because we've got to build up some of these ideas and these new habits of thought before the transphysical worlds can become rationally intelligible to us in a way that might be useful.
Question taken off from what Michael has opened up. So, when an occasion is prehending the entire state of the universe and that stuff is objectified for it, what is the status of that entire history? Is that... It must be actual in some sense to be causal, yet it's not happening right in the now.
That's right. According to process philosophy.
But it has
It has causal effect.
It has a evolutionary but still persistent character.
That's right. So Whitehead says is that actual occasions, when they finish their moment of subjective immediacy, perish into objective immortality.
Okay, so it's a eternal, they're eternal.
They're eternal. In other words, they become the past actual occasions begin to characterize creativity so that what it creates now is affected by what it created before. And in that sense, it has objective immortality as a character of the universe henceforth. Good question. Well, it has an answer for it. That's an easy
question. Yeah, I guess. Nice to have that.
This has also gotten me started thinking about the eternal objects and why we have them and where exactly they come in. You know, does an occasion pull them in while it's making decisions?
Yes.
But why do we need them? So we have all these expired actual occasions out there that also have these frameworks, or in a
That's
sense
right.
they have all the eternal objects in them that have
That's...
never been manifested.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can get that information from expired actual occasions, is the eternal forms, is it just a something to help us talk about it? In
no.
a sense, or does it actually exist somewhere?
Is it literal?
Just,
that's
yeah,
exactly
that's a very good
getting.
Question. So let me approach that question by going into the lecture. Okay? Now, did you guys should do the reading? You have something you want to say, Kim?
Well, I was just thinking, in Aristotelian terms, you have form and substance come together to create theme. And in the Whitehead, you have form and creativity come together to create event.
Yeah.
And we just push... But then how does the substance come? I mean, you still have a creative force that wants to manifest things into being to bring substance and forms together.
Now, did any of you read the chapter? How many of you read the chapter? Well, that's what the chapter's about. Okay, so let me go through it. Now, let me try to talk about this a little bit. Try to trying to figure out where to start. Let's start with the mythic consciousness for a moment. I want to do this historically. I want to talk about historically how our relationship to eternal objects has evolved over the past 2,000 or 3,000 years. Okay, so let's go back to mythic times. And in mythic times, as we've seen, the world is objectified by being personified. Right? So in the mythic world, we grab hold of or conceptualize the world around us by understanding it as a collection of living beings in familial interactions. That's the mythic view of the world. Right? So just, you feel that, right? It's like, you know, we make the world a bunch of things in time and space. They made it a bunch of persons in familial interactions. Right? So it's a very different way of grabbing the universe. And as we know from our own minor forays into mythic consciousness, as an example through archetypal astrology, it's easy for us to begin to imagine that behind the play of appearance are these gods and goddesses, these archetypal complexes, and that in waking life, things come to have the forms they have through the intervention of these archetypal divinities. Right? So what we do in the mythic is we objectify the world by making it a family of gods and goddesses and mortals. And we see the characteristics of the things as coming from the gods and goddesses. Right? Now, then the mythic breaks down, partly because the mental starts to develop, and all of a sudden, all the myths start to seem silly relative to each other. Every city has their own gods and goddesses, and people start to think, well, that can't make sense. And so they start to look for something to bind the world together now that the mythic story is no longer creating a sense of wholeness. Right? With me? Okay, so then the mental mutation develops. Now, what's interesting in the mental mutation is that instead of objectifying the world as personalities, as persons, it begins to objectify the world as things and ideas. Instead of persons and families, it's now things bound together by patterns of ideas. So you see what happens? You move into a new world. Suddenly we move into this objectified spatial world out of a world of pure psychology. We move into a world of physics, right? See how that happens? Okay, now, the great event that in the 5th century launches the mental mutation among the Greeks is this discovery of ideas, of forms, right? So now, people before the mental mutation knew that things could be red. That wasn't the problem, right? But red would be associated with the archetypal qualities of Mars, and it would have a certain psychological association, so forth and so on, right? But here, in the mental mutation, for the first time, someone looks at red and says, red. Redness. Right? They begin to pull out of experience these elements of form, of abstract form. Redness, roundness, angriness, right? Goodness, right? And so suddenly the world opens up in a new way, and now we begin to see the world as this realm of form and a fluent and changing realm of everyday life. Now, the realm of form, why is there a realm of form? Because it begins to become clear that once we start abstracting forms out of nature, the forms themselves enter into systematic interrelations. Right? So, for example, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet are all colors. Right? So there's a categorical arrangement, right? Square, round, and so forth, those are shapes, right? Colors and shapes are both qualities. And so we begin to see, even in Aristotle's time, that there's a structure to the realm of the eternal objects. Now, forms and events. Now, you said, why do we need the forms? Right? So So here's a question, right? Like, we know that this cup is never the same event twice. But something is the same. There's some feature of the cup by virtue of which we can recognize it over and over again. We can recognize it, right? What enables us to recognize this cup as the same cup? It's the form that it has, right? This sort of generally cylindrical shape and these different colors, right? It's like this is the form of the cup, and it's remaining the same, more or less, even as the events of the cup are in a constant process of transformation. And so the question is, how do we recognize sameness in perception?
Well, we recognized it once, so then that's an expired actual occasion. So it exists there for us to use so that we can recognize the same thing again. Like, why does it have to be its own form?
Where'd you get it the first time, though?
Yeah, where'd you get it the first time? So you're recognizing the form that's ingredient in the cup the first time.
Yeah, still perceiving the form, not the cup. The cup is secondary. It just points to the form. Focus your attention to the form.
Well, one thing is let's look at the forms. Take redness. Okay, and let's imagine a particular shade of red. Let's say I'm going to say the words fire engine red, and each one of you will picture some shade of red. I don't know what it is, but it's a shade of red you're all picturing, right? Now, that particular shade of red, you've probably seen before. And if you see it again, you can recognize it again as being the same shade of red. And so that feature of your experience, the feature of experience designated by that shade of red, is unchanging. It never changes. Every time you apprehend that shade of red, you're apprehending the same form. So this form here, the circle form, you recognize it here in the cup, but you've seen it a million times before, and you can see it a million times again, and you can actually hold it in your imagination and intend to make that form appear in a painting or a sculpture or something, right? But the form is the same form. The form of circle is the same every time you notice it.
So maybe this is a distinction. So to me, that's implying that the universe was created with these forms, and we have to choose among them.
That's correct.
But why couldn't it be, if it's just created with creativity, and the first time anything makes that form, because...
How would you recognize it the first time?
Yeah, the very first time anything's ever made. I guess you could start with a realm populated already, or you could populate it as you go along.
Well, I don't think that's... I think actually it's not... I don't think that makes sense. I mean, a lot of people try to make this argument, and so it probably has some truth in it. Otherwise people wouldn't make it, right? It seems to me that let me come in from another angle. Okay, I want to suggest that we consider the identity between the forms and possibilities. I want to suggest that the nature of the forms that we abstract from our experience is that they are possibilities, or as Whitehead would say, forms of potential definiteness. So the function of redness in the universe is that redness is a possibility. It's the possibility for something to be red. The possibility for something to be red is not itself red or anything else, but it is the possibility of redness. Right? So what we were learning... So let's see. I'm trying to do too many things at once. Okay, we're at the beginning of the mental meditation. We're talking about forms. Okay, forms are possibilities. That's the point I want to make, right? Is that whenever I think red, blue, conscious, round, angry, hungry, whatever, right, I'm contemplating a possibility that things have had in the past and might have in the future. Make sense? Okay, so those are possibilities. Now the question is, right now, there are a lot of possibilities that are relevant that aren't being acted on at this moment. Right? I could do the head of the party.
Howard.
I could do a Howard Dean thing and scream my lungs off, right? And you could all be upset at me, right? So that's a form that could ingress in my speech.
How is it real, though?
What?
Can we investigate how real it is?
In the sense of being an actual possibility. Right? Now, this is something that quantum mechanics also recognizes. There are objective probabilities. Right? So what I'm suggesting is that if we look at our existential situation moment to moment, we find ourselves in this concrete situation. But every concrete situation is surrounded by a halo or a nimbus of possibilities. So every actual situation is partially constituted by the possibilities that it opens up. And those possibilities are real. They're not actual, but they're real possibilities among which an actual occasion will choose as it concresses. Right? So now if you look at natural law, what is, in the scientific sense, what is natural law? And I would like to suggest that natural law is a structured field of possibilities. That makes sense to you? Right? So if I pick up my glasses and hold them like this, we all have a pretty good idea what will happen if I let go. Right? They'll fall 32 feet per second per second. Right? That's a structure of possibility. In other words, the possibilities opening up from this gesture include the possibility of falling at 32 feet per second per second if I let go. It's a structure of possibility. Natural law is a structure of possibility, and the possibility is actually determining what is possible in this moment. Right? So the forms are real. And to contemplate a form is to consider the possibility of actualizing a potentiality. Yeah.
So I just want to try to make sure I understand your definition of real. It sounds to me that you're using that word to mean something that is potentially actual.
Mm-mm.
So how do you define
real? Good question.
Real?
So real is a category, and there are two species of things that are real, actuality and potentialities.
So real is a category consisting of those two.
That's correct. These are the two types of real thing.
What is
actual things and possibilities.
What is the reality of their distinction?
Well, it's in the chapter. Let's go through it. But let me get to that in a minute. Let me go back to the historical thing, and then we'll go through that exactly, because it's a big analysis in there. Okay, so we get to the beginning of the mental mutation, and we start to be able to think in terms of abstract forms. Right, so this is both a loss and an advance, like any mutation is, but it's an interesting one. And in this mental world that opens up, it's a very secure world. Right? So Aristotle and all the ancient philosophers, having discovered the possibility of thinking in abstractions, which they call reason, right, now begin to celebrate reason as the core of their anthropology. Right? So that they begin to understand humanity as the rational, reasonable animal. Now, by the way, reason in those days is richer than it is now, because aesthetics and ethics are just as much a part of reason as is science and philosophy. So it's a richer and more concrete understanding of what reason is. Reason is the capacity to step back, to look, to evaluate, to see things in the context of a larger body of ideas, right? To make moral and aesthetic judgments. These are all the characteristics that belong to reason. But what's interesting about this mental world that opens up is that it's very clear to the people in ancient times that mind and nature are necessarily and inherently coordinated with each other. There's a kind of divinely ordained, pre-established harmony, so that what I think about reality is assumed to reveal the way reality really is. Right? So there's this sense of just complete epistemological self-assurance. Now, part of the way this works is that Aristotle had Aristotle's ontology and Aristotle's logic corresponded to each other in a way that we've forgotten. So that for Aristotle, there's this realm, what I would call a realm of eternal objects, which for Aristotle consists of a hierarchy of categories. So somehow this hierarchy of categories is an overarching structure of possibility within which the world is unfolding. Right? And Aristotle was clear that all of the forms that ever will be useful are already useful. That is, he saw the world as consisting of a finite stock of forms which are simply endlessly repeated. So it's a steady state universe. There's no evolution in Aristotle's world. And then when Aristotle analyzed the world, he analyzed it into these entities, these ousia, these natural things. And the process through which an actual thing was thought to come into being is a process of definition. Right? So we'd start out here with a formless substance, and then we would add the qualities of an inorganic thing, and then we'd add roundness and cylindricalness, and then we'd add the colors. And so this thing would come into being as the various forms would express themselves in substance. Right? And then we would understand the thing by seeing which categories of forms are ingressed into it. And so the process of our understanding on the one hand and the process of its coming into being on the other are the same process. You see how that works for Aristotle? And so it makes a very cozy universe. And as we've seen, there are certain problems with that universe. It underemphasizes relationality, and it doesn't appreciate the full significance of mathematics, but it still creates a nice human world for people to live in for several thousand years. Right? And then that world begins to break down with the Renaissance, and we move into the deficient mental. Now, in the deficient mental, we no longer see the world in terms of events and objects. We get a whole new category. And that category is the atom. And the atom differs from any earlier idea in that the atom is a substance that is always and already intrinsically formed. Right, so there's no process in an early modern atom. It's actually a pure abstraction. It's a point mass. And all process is taken out of the existence of substance, which therefore becomes purely abstract. So now, like in the mythic world, we saw all the properties coming from the gods and the goddesses already had their forms. Now in the deficient mental world, we see all the forms as coming out of the atoms, which are already formed. Right? And so we lose track of the whole distinction between events and ideas in the modern world, which is a kind of a deficient mythical thinking. Deficient because it's collapsed into vacuous actuality, but mythic because it divides the world up into entities that already have the properties, instead of understanding that everything exists in a process of receiving its qualities dynamically. Right? So then we end up with this deficient mental understanding, and in this deficient mental understanding, we construe the relationship between consciousness and matter as an outside-inside distinction. Right? So the physical world, the actual world, is out there, and we're somehow in here behind our senses. Right? And so we get this weird idea that the actual world is out there, independent of us, maybe even causally closed, and we're often some epiphenomenal viewpoint scrambling to exist in this modern world. Right? So now we're trying to move beyond that modern world because we can't understand the transphysical in terms of the modern idea of atoms. And so we go back to the efficient mental idea of events and objects. Right? And what I want to claim is that if we do a kind of epoche, a kind of phenomenological epoche, and we just look
act our experience and we don't do objectifying, if we deliberately suspend our objectifying, as I've said, we uncover the field of experience that we can look at instead of through. And my claim is, and Whitehead's claim, is that the most interesting and useful way to analyze the field of bare experience is in terms of events and the objects that are ingredient in them. That if we start there, we can then derive science and occultism and spirituality and everything else from our own experience. We can see how they become constructed from our own experience if we start with this beginning analysis. Yeah, Caleb.
In Aristotle's idea, when form and substance come together, what is it that's putting them together?
Good question. For Aristotle, the initiative is placed on the part of the forms.
So the forms is the god as well.
Yeah,
the forms are the gods.
What?
The forms are the gods, I think I remember.
They're abstractions from the god. They're dead gods and goddesses in a certain way, right? But the forms are seen as having the energy. They actually have potentiality, right? Which lets them ingress into substance and then function in the world. That's their energia, their energy, right? Where they function.
So is Whitehead getting rid of substance and splitting creativity off from the forms? Splitting forms into creativity and idea?
Oh, sorry, Whitehead. Is that again what you said?
So is Whitehead dropping substance and splitting form into form and creativity?
Whitehead, we got Aristotle, form and substance.
Mm-hmm.
Whitehead, form and process.
Creativity
is behind all that. So creativity is what puts it together.
Is creativity the energia?
No,
putting together the form and...
No. Because energy is already an accomplished form. So creativity is that which, see, in Whitehead, the forms are passive, whereas in Aristotle, they're active. And you can trace this is a several thousand year process through which the valence changes from the forms being active to the matter being active. So for Whitehead, there's this creativity, and we feel creativity because the energy, the dynamis of creativity is that on which we live. I mean, every moment as we feel ourselves functioning as beings in the world, we are expressing creativity, right? So there's creativity. At the very beginning for Whitehead, there's creativity and the eternal objects, right? Those are the two main things he's got.
And there's nothing behind that bringing those together.
No. Whitehead's vague about the huger picture there. But for Whitehead, creativity first prehends all the forms and puts them in order, and that's what Whitehead calls the primordial mind of God. The point is that we live within an objective field of possibility. In other words, there's an actual order, which is the order of the past, things that have actually happened. And then there's the order of the possible. What can happen? What possibilities could be manifest? Now, this is just like science in a certain way. Science imagines that as of the Big Bang, there's this structure of possibility, which it calls natural law. And then the energies or the events that have come into being at the Big Bang are flowing, as it were, through these laws and realizing what possibilities they can in the context of the laws, right? And it seems to me that whether we accept scientific laws as ultimate, there's a way in which all of experience is contained within a structure of possibility. That is, what's possible going forward, what will be actual going forward is not yet determined. But the possibilities are determined and have been determined from the beginning and timelessly. Right, so that in order to understand our world, we have to operate in terms both of an ideal order, the ordering of the possibilities, and an actual order, the ordering of the actualities. Yeah.
So one of the implications of
some of this discussion seems to be that modern science tends to be sort of with Aristotle in viewing there to be a finite number of forms. I'm not putting this well, but there's something about, there's a way in which modern science limits possibility.
That's
it seems analogous to Aristotle's limitation of form and persistence of substance, somehow.
That's correct. So for one thing, modern science only allows the relevance of mathematical forms, which is very collapsed, because it doesn't allow for purpose or love or intention or inspiration or religion or anything, right? Doesn't allow for ethics and aesthetics at all. All it allows for is mathematics. That's very collapsed. But the other thing is that when we get into the Newtonian, the really deficient mental world, you're right, the world becomes a fixed order of possibilities. And not only that, but all choice is abstracted out of the system. Right? And so we begin to think that the entire universe is a closed system of mathematical equations. Right? So that nothing outside of that matters. Right? And so we end up in the early modern times with this idea that the possible and the actual are so collapsed that only one thing is possible, and that is what will be actualized. And so there's no room for any freedom in the system because possibility and actuality, in a sense, collapse in the Newtonian system. Right? So in a deterministic system, possibility and actuality collapse. And it is analogous to Aristotle, just as you say, because it creates a closed universe of fixed possibilities that can only repeat, which is actually deficient mythic some way.
That goes back to my question about the reality between the distinction of actual and possible. So for Whitehead, there is an actual distinction between...
Very clear. So let's go to that. And the readings. I don't have the same one you have, so we're going to have some troubles with pages. I never got a copy of the reader. But we're talking up here about chapter 4. So right at the very beginning, in the first page, talking about forms and events. And then I say that events are in time. So now we're talking about the distinction, right? So every event is in time.
Like bodies in space.
Like bodies
in space. Classic idea.
That's right. And this is in time. In other words, every event happens at a particular place and at a particular time. We have to define those terms. Not talking about absolute space, but in any case, each event, like my event right now, is happening right here in this room on this date and will never be repeated. I will never say this sentence again. Right? So events are in time. They're contextualized by the past and the future, always.
Right?
Now, ideas are not in time in that sense, because ideas, an event, can only be understood concretely. But a form can only be understood abstractly. Right? So if I say redness, redness does not have the same relationship to time as your red sweater. It's a different relationship to time. Your red sweater is right there on your body right now. But redness is everywhere in a certain sense. Redness is with all creation. Because it's always possibility that it's always possible in principle, it's not in practice, that something red could arise here. Right? So that the abstractions are not in time the way events are. That's one of the big differences. Okay. Now also, okay, that's how we lose track of it. Fallacy of misplaced completeness. Okay, so several pages in, it says forms are possibilities, actualities are events. It's a subsection. About 4 or 5 pages in. You see
91.
That?
91.
What?
91.
91 for you guys, page 91. Okay, so we'll go to the main points here, right? So, first of all, ideas are possibilities. That's what they are. Now, why is that interesting? One of the interesting questions I've always been asking my whole life is, what is thinking? What do we do when we're thinking? What is this odd activity that we engage in so powerfully in our lives? If we understand abstractions to be forms of possibility, then we can say that what we're doing when we think is working with the structure of possibility. And in a high grade occasion like me, I apprehend the world. I can pull some pretty rich ideas out of it by abstraction. And then I can iterate those ideas. Right? So I can say, you know, I know that if I build a fire, it gets hot. I know if I put water on it, it'll steam up. Maybe I can use the steam to power a piston. Right? So this is this incredible, elaborate concatenation of ideas which enables us to build a steam engine over a couple hundred years. Right? So when we're thinking, we are actually working with the future, with the shape of the future, with what is possible. And then in each moment, we work up a model of what's possible and then choose what to do next in relation to that model. I forgot what I was going again. I'm sorry. I'm just spacing these late. Yeah, Chris.
So does thinking,
yes, thinking
operate outside of concrescence?
No. But it does operate in all concrescence. Right? So my contention would be that when a subatomic particle elaborates the probability matrix and decides what to become, it's thinking. Not in our sense, of course, not linguistically, but it's a kind of pre-linguistic thinking in which possibilities are elaborated and choices are made. Right? And so the elaboration of possibilities and the choice among them is intrinsic to every event in the universe. That's the idea here. Now, let's look at an implication of that. I'm claiming, Whitehead's claiming, that all the actual occasions in the universe are operating in the context of the same objective order of possibility. To put this in scientific language, it says, all things are subject to natural law. I'm just saying that in Whiteheadian language, okay? So everything in the universe is subject to this same framework of possibility. So I take in the universe, and I see what possibilities have been realized in the past, and I get them from the past, but then I try to see what's possible next. And it may happen that in my process of doing this, I think my way to a possibility that has never before been realized by any occasion in the past. And now I can realize it. Now that's the process explanation for evolutionary emergence. And it says that all the possibilities are there to be actualized. But we can't get to all the possibilities from everywhere. Because in each moment, even though there's an overall objective framework of possibility, the specific possibilities that are available to me in this moment are totally conditioned by the past. So that whatever I do next has to be logically consistent, I'm using that word very deliberately, with what has already happened. I cannot, at this moment, punch the elevator button on the first floor, because that would be inconsistent with my having come up here this morning. Right? So the possibilities that are open to me in this moment are all contingent on the fact that I'm starting from right here, and therefore dependent on my past decisions. Right, so in each moment, there's a restricted range of possibility opened up for us, depending on the past. But that restricted domain of possibility is part of the larger subset of everything that's possible. And that doesn't change, according to this way of analyzing the actual world. Yeah.
So it seems that another implication of this, vis-a-vis this whole comparison of Aristotle and modern science to Whitehead, is that logic for Aristotle is different from, I mean, when you say logically consistent, you're not necessarily meaning exactly the same thing that Aristotle would say would mean by logically
consistent.
That's right.
Thank you. Yeah, we have a different kind of logic.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the new logic shares certain features in common with Aristotle's logic, namely
it's
avoidance of contradiction.
Or whatever.
And, yeah.
Super yeah.
Okay. So ideas are possibilities, events are actual occasions. Right? actual occasions actualize by making decisions. So Aristotle had said that things become actual by a process of definition in which the forms force themselves into the substance. Whitehead says that an actual occasion, which is an expression of primordial creativity, in its process of concrescence decides what to be. And so it decides the forms that will ingress in it. And so now the agency has been shifted from the form side to the process side. Right? And somebody could probably turn the whole thing over into another philosophy based on that. But this particular philosophy is very nicely consistent with modern values, in part because it opens up the possibility of freedom in a way that if form was active, freedom wouldn't be apparent in the same way as it is if there's something which selects which form come in. Right, so that shows us how mind is intrinsically involved in nature. Right? Because actual occasions actualize by making decisions, which means that everything comes to have the character it does have because of a decision on the part of an actual occasion. Right? The possibilities are neutral, but the actual occasions decide which possibilities they will ingress.
What's the difference between the actual occasion and the decision?
The decision is a function of the actual occasion. The actual occasion does things other than deciding. Right? It receives information, it interprets, and so forth, and then it decides. But so deciding is what an actual occasion does at the culmination of its process. Mm-hmm.
But it is, so the impression or evaluation of the possibilities is primary to the decision.
That's right.
That's the part that I'm having trouble with. How is it possible to separate the two motions?
And which two motions?
The seeing the possibilities and the choosing one. It seems like an actual occasion is a decision, in a way.
Well, actual occasions decide. I'm not going to say they are decisions.
So what are decisions? If actual occasions are the primary building blocks of reality, what are decisions?
Well, the word decision means cutting off. Mm-hmm. Right? A decision is a selection among possibilities. Right? A decision is a selection among various possibilities.
You said it was a function?
It's a function of an actual occasion. It decides, in other words. Actual occasion, one of the functions of an actual occasion is to decide which possibilities to actualize.
One of the processes?
Wait, hold on. Let me talk to Michael.
That notion of directionality, though, just seems like it's only a function of linear thought.
Well, you're going to have to give us a presentation on what your problem is with linear thought.
It's not a problem. I just see it as only one way of viewing time. But if time is only considered through linear thought, then you can't question what time is after that. It's not self-reflective. It doesn't see its own blind spot.
You're raising a very deep objection to this whole mode of thought. I'm interested in it. I mean, I will freely acknowledge that in process thought, as it has been so far developed, the linearity of time is an important component. So, for example, the process philosophers who are dealing with parapsychology, David Ray Griffin in particular, has written a whole book or essay with like 38 different explanations of precognition that don't involve precognition, because he's desperate to maintain linearity of time. I do not believe linearity of time is ultimate.
It seems like you do, though. And that's
not, no, no.
It doesn't sound like you do. But
yeah, because you're not, that's because you don't understand my way of teaching.
Okay.
Right? So I am teaching you a system of thought. I am teaching you a system of thought because I believe it to be a very important milestone in the direction of integral thinking.
Yeah.
It is not complete. It is not ultimate in any way. And so I find that having, like right now, I'm just about getting this book ready for publication in the next few months. I'm almost done. And I'm going to publish my dissertation. I'm writing a chapter for the new book Esalen is publishing. Yeah. And then I'm fucking done with this.
Yeah. It's right? More Whitehead that I'm unclear about, and I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, but I want to say something. But this model goes a really long way toward opening up science and opening up an approach to the transphysical worlds. It is, in my opinion, the most advanced model I've ever seen. But it's just another model. And I'm already starting to question it in a lot of ways and starting to think about putting together a much more general version that's much more responsive to some of the stuff that you're bringing up. So I want you to get that I understand the limits of what I'm teaching. Okay? So yes, in this book, in this model, linear time is presupposed. Linearity of time is presupposed. That's a limitation of the model. However, the way in which time is linear is very important. And so analyzing things in this context is not a waste of time.
No. Yeah.
The next iteration has to open this up deeper. And you may be able to help me with that. I'm really interested in what you do with subjecting these ideas to the criticism involved in their excessive linearity. So where does that take us? Right? Because in a lot of ways I want to open this system up. That's one of them. You understand that? Makes sense?
Yeah. I understand.
Yeah. I mean, we should talk about this some other time. I have lots of ideas about the non-linearity of time, but they just aren't showing up here because what I'm trying to do is just take science to a next step.
In asking originally, I was trying to understand what Whitehead meant by the actual occasion and how that maybe, when you said he resolved the mind-body problem,
yeah.
To me, if you resolve the mind-body problem, then you resolve the problem of change. So I'm wondering if we can apply his resolution of the mind-body problem to that. Did he apply it to time? And that's why I'm sort of pressing.
Absolutely. The point is that creativity is the origin of time, right? And concrescence is the expression of time. And he's talking about how things come to have the characters they do through this process of decision, which he's analyzing.
Okay.
And I'm not quite sure what your question is.
Now that I know that was his, I wasn't sure what part was Whitehead, what part was you and Whitehead, what part was
right. Well,
part
you know, I strongly suggest that you read Stubborn Fact and Creative Advance by Thomas Hosinski. Because I think, given the questions you're asking me, you're going to need a deeper grounding on what Whitehead has to say. Okay, anything else there? Yeah.
I'm afraid I have to sort of ask the question I asked earlier again.
Good.
The answer was quick, and I thought I got it. So you have this objectified past, which is eternal. That's a form in some sense. How is it then causal?
What?
Because forms aren't causal, right?
It's not just a form. It's an actuality. It's an objectively immortal actuality. In other words, just like in science, we say...
Objectively immortal.
Look, in science, once an event has collapsed, the fact of that collapse is a feature of the Schrodinger wave equation going forward, right? It's preserved eternally because the Schrodinger wave equation is linear. Right? That's a form of objective immortality, right? Because it means that once, at this moment, everything that happened in the universe, everything that happened in any of our past light cones, is causally effective right now. Right? I wouldn't be here if the Big Bang weren't here, and I wouldn't be who I was if the Big Bang hadn't been precisely as it is. Now, assuming there was a Big Bang, which I consider very speculative, assuming there was, then the Big Bang is in effect objectively immortal because it's still having causal effects.
Well, wait a minute. Maybe I'm wrong. I thought forms did not have causal.
The Big Bang was not a form. It was an event.
Right.
And the event
it's
is toast, not...
It's no longer actual.
But the energy of that is still actual. The causal power of it still has an effect on the present.
There must be an occasion of some sort.
It's a society of occasions. It's an event, which includes many occasions.
But there is a thing about, I mean, because I think the question you were asking earlier about why do we have to have the forms, and it sounded to me like you kind of wanted to go to a past actual occasions. I'm not sure, but I know I was thinking about the very same thing before class, And there is something about the past and about expired actual occasions that's form-like in a certain way,
absolutely,
even though they're not forms. And I think that gets to the question that Bill's asking as well.
The point is, they are not, there are forms. At the end of an actual occasion, it has its final satisfaction. And the final satisfaction of an actual occasion is essentially a proposition which says, this occasion was here and characterized itself in this way. So there's an element of form in it. But there's also energy in it. There's actual causal energy. Because what happened back there wasn't a form, it was an event. And events have causal power. Let me say something.
I mean, I can understand this in a scientific sense. I can understand the words you just said. I'm trying to square with the definitions of actual forms and causality in Whitehead's system. And so there's objectified actual occasions. That's the ones that have expired but have this residue of causal effect.
That's right. That's right.
But that seems like a separate category from actual occasions or forms.
They're expired actual occasions.
Okay, so you'd have to say forms or potentialities and actualities and eternal historical causalities.
Well, Whitehead handles that. Whitehead handles that by saying that the expired actual occasions become part of the character of creativity.
Okay, I'm trying to compact it.
Well, it seems to me that one of the distinctions is that with actual occasions that are occurring or are about to occur, the field of possibility hasn't collapsed, so to speak.
Has?
Whereas,
there's
a structure. Yeah, if an actual occasion that's about to happen, it hasn't occurred yet. So it's inside a structured field of possibility that hasn't collapsed into what it will become.
Right, exactly.
But in the past, there is a relationship of expired actual occasions to forms in the sense that they don't have possibility anymore. They may have this
energy, but
they're sort of frozen.
That's right.
And we tend to think of the forms as being frozen as well in a certain metaphorical
way. Well, in a certain sense, the forms characterizing the past are in an important sense frozen. That's what it means to say it's the past.
Right?
So the past is fixed. The past is given. At every moment, we emerge out of a given past.
And in the same way, we are part of a structured field of possibility that includes whatever eternal objects are actually there and not anything else. So there's something about a limitation of it in that respect that resonates between the two somehow,
look,
I think.
I come out of the past at every moment. And the past conditions what's possible for me. Right? So I have some relationship to the total field of what's possible. I can imagine sprouting wings and flying out the window, but it's not a practical possibility for me at this moment because the past hasn't set it up. Right? So there's the past, which is a structured field of what was possible, and then there's the present, which emerges out of that, which has its own finite set of possibilities that are given by the past in the context of a larger field of possibilities which governs the whole universal evolution.
Is this making more sense to you now?
Well, let me try this.
Let me say one more thing.
This all shows up in prehensions. In a concressing actual occasion. So it has actuality in the occasion that's feeling this.
That's right. The past has actuality in each actual occasion.
That
in other words,
right.
In a certain sense, each actual occasion relives the whole of the past. In a sense.
In some ways, it's like ingressing something, too.
Well, one of the things, according to Aristotle's idea, universals characterize particulars. Right? So a substance has character. But particulars don't characterize each other. Right? But for Whitehead, they do. For Whitehead, each actual occasion includes in its own body the entirety of the past, which it in effect relives, reanimates in its own experience.
Isn't that interesting? There's no problem there at all whatsoever in my head. It's part of making these shifts into this other way of looking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. See, in the way we usually think, the way we've been taught to think, the present alone is actual. And the past is gone and the future is not yet. But Whitehead says no. That in fact, every moment includes the past and the future in its very structure. And so the entirety of the past is present again in each moment of our existence. This is also another way to look at the Akashic record in some way, right? In other words, the implication is that my actual occasion, this moment, contains a knowledge of everything that's happened in the universe leading up to me. And that with the proper kind of concentration, I should be able to access it.
Indeed, too. Excellent. Yeah.
And the process or function is what endures from occasion to occasion?
Well, so the process is...
The process or function is the thing that endures...
Well, creativity endures.
Creativity endures.
And yeah.
And then what's the function or process? When you call it the process which does all that.
Concrescence.
The process of concrescence?
Yes, that's it. The process of concrescence is the process through which actual occasions come into being. It's the fundamental process of actuality. Okay. And there's no actualization without thinking and deciding, right? So nothing becomes actual without deciding what it's going to be. Right? Which brings consciousness, thinking, deciding, final causation back into the center of the natural world. It is consciousness that makes the actual world have the character that it does. Now, okay, events have a character that is more or less complex, right? So every event has a character, and the character of the cup or my eyeglasses is not as complex as the character of me, right? So you can see that events differ in the complexity of the forms that character of. Abstractions are always beheld by actuality. This is an interesting point. Because in order to have the only entity that can have any awareness of an abstraction is an actual entity. Right? So ideas, when we talk about ideas, they're always ideas as beheld. They're concrete ideas. Ideas as entertained in concrescence. So, okay. Abstractions can be more or less adequate to the objects they represent. Right? So I could just call you one of my students, that's very abstract, or I could say, oh, you're Richard, that's much more concrete. Right? So I can use abstractions to describe people and events that are more or less adequate to who and what they are. And no set of abstractions can encompass the totality of what it describes. I should have said no finite set of eternal objects can fully characterize any actuality. Right? Because actuality is infinitely rich. Every actual occasion has some relationship to every entity in its past and to every possibility there is. And so each actual occasion is infinitely complex. This should frustrate scientists who are trying to find simple things at the bottom. Here we find at the very bottom of the actual world things that are infinitely complex, which are actually sort of fractal divinities. Okay, now another section that I thought. Here it is. Okay, so we've been talking about the characteristics of the eternal objects. But then it says here, the characteristics of actuality. So I'm responding to your question, Michael. Right? So as opposed to the abstractions, to the forms, I don't know what page is there.
100.
What?
100.
So actuality requires consciousness. There is nothing that is actual that is not conscious. Actuality consists of actual occasions are necessarily aware, and so everything is characterized by consciousness. Actuality is temporal, that is, actual things unfold in time, whereas events don't. Events just remain what they are forever. So that's a big difference between them. Actuality is communal, that is, you never find a solitary actuality. Every actuality emerges out of a complex past and anticipates a complex future.
When I read actuality is temporal, I just thought about the integral age. Isn't one of the characteristics that's going to be atemporal?
Well, no, that's not exactly right. See, that's a really good question. So, Gebser says that that the integral age is all about time, and it's all about process. But it recognizes that time comes in many, many forms. So, for example, time comes in the form of a clock time, and in the form of natural time, and in the form of cosmic time, and in the form of biological time, and in the form of psychic activity, and even in the form of motoricity, or the way time manifests in machinery. And so the manifestations of time are many and complex. And so when Gebser talks about the achronon, or time freedom, what he means is a situation in which we can work transparently with all the different manifestations of time and understand them in their interrelationships, but not so that we're not experiencing time. As he says, it's not freedom from time, it's freedom for time. Okay? And actuality, being communal, is also causal, right? So eternal objects are engaged in logical relations with each other, but they are not engaged in causal relations with each other. They don't affect each other. They're implicated in each other's being. That is, each actual occasion is partly defined by its relationship to all the others. But it's a logical connection and not a causal connection. Whereas actual things are involved in causal interactions. Okay, let's stop with that for now. So I hope this clarifies the distinction between the realm of the possible and the realm of the actual. The realm of the possible is timeless and is logically structured. If you're interested in going more deeply into this, in chapter 10 of Science and the Modern World, Whitehead considers this whole issue exhaustively. And I wrote a long commentary on this chapter, which was published in Process Studies Supplements. So if you just put it out of the browser. It's also on my website.
And this is talking about actuality or temporality?
It's talking about the relationship between eternal objects and actual occasions and how they interact. So you might find it particularly interesting. And my commentary helps. The chapter is very, very dense and requires a lot of background to make sense of it. So my commentary is a useful one for that chapter. What falls out of this way of seeing is that it explains why mathematical descriptions are useful. This is one of the big questions of science. The question is, why is it that mathematical equations actually describe what's going on? So a lot of people point out that the mathematical systems that we use are in some very important sense free creations. And we might imagine that all, in fact, we could say that all the eternal objects of mathematics and all of their relationships must exist already in the realm of the possible. But the fact is that the human intellect is only able to perceive very little bits of the logical structuring of things. It's much more mysterious than you'd imagine, right? So that, you know, we get an idea and we can see a few implications, but then the implications, it might take thousands of years to explore the further implications of that idea. And you'll often see in the history of thought that certain ideas will come up. Atomism, for example, came up 2,500 years ago, but didn't really begin to express its full possibilities until the modern era. Theory of conic sections, 2,500 years ago, but didn't find its applications until modern times, right? And then people will look back at old theories, like for example, Euclid, taken for granted for hundreds of years, thousands of years, then it turns out that it's incomplete, right? People see new possibilities in the geometry. So our ability to see the logical relations is quite finite. But the point is this, if we live in this structured field of possibility, and if this structured field of possibility is the same for all actual occasions, number one, number two, if when I'm thinking, I'm working with possibilities. Right? So first, I pull in the past, I apprehend the past, I pull out some abstractions, and then I start looking at those abstractions and how they relate to each other and what else is possible and so forth. That's all thinking, right? But thinking is working with possibility, which means that as I'm elaborating possibilities, I'm sort of tracing my way through this existing structure of possibility. Right? So as I'm moving through space, I'm making certain calculations about position, right? And so I have some sense of how that works. And then the atoms, they're doing the same thing. They're moving through space. And so the atom, an atom in a particular location in three-dimensional space and in time, has certain trajectories that open up from there, which it can calculate. Right? And if I look at it, I can see it's over there, and I can see what the possibilities are, and I can calculate them too. Why is that? Because the field of possibility in which I exist, the field of possibility in which the atom exists, are the same field of possibility. And so what it does is deciding what character to have. And what I do when I'm deciding what character I want to have is the same process, working with the same field of possibility. And so since both me and the atom are subject to the same field of mathematical probabilities, my thinking corresponds to its thinking. Because thinking is tracing out the outlines of this field of possibility, which is objective for both of us. And so since we're both actual, and since to be actual means to work with possibility, and since we're all working with the same field of possibility, therefore our thinking through the field and Adam's thinking through the field will come up with the same results. So our thinking can predict its movement. That's only possible if we exist in the structure of a common field of possibility that we all share and that every actual occasion in our universe also shares.
Wow. That answers my question a lot about the relations of ideas and language too.
Yeah. And in this commentary, I elaborate this in a much deeper way, this idea. So this is one of the big advantages we get. We actually get an epistemology which lets us understand why mathematics does what it does in science. I consider that pretty cool. All right, so then the last thing to do is to think through briefly here the process of actualization. And I made a few points here. First, that we experience the past as it actually was. Now this is very important. It's important because without that, there would be no continuity in the universe. There'd be no causal continuity. Right? So the initial prehensions of a new concrescence are, as Whitehead says, conformal. Which means, for example, that as I feel you as you were a second ago, right? And so I feel your mood, I feel the intensity of your consciousness, I feel your tension, I feel your relaxation, I feel everything about you to a certain extent, right? Like your experience is duplicated in my experience. I re-experience your experience in this moment. So that I am having, to some extent, a re-experience of all the experiences of all the actual occasions of my past life come. The transmission of energy in process philosophy is the transmission of experience, right? Not some abstract token of experience, but experience itself is what's transmitted. And so I take you in, and necessarily I take you in as you were. Otherwise, like I say, then there'd be no continuity between me and the past, the whole universe would disintegrate. So the solidarity of the universe requires that the initial prehensions of an occasion are conformal. However, although I feel you just as you were, including whatever subjective form was characterizing you, and this, by the way, is where this is the justification for the whole psychic enterprise in some way, right? As I feel you conformally, I also have my own reaction to you, and that's free. So, for example,
you might come at me feeling really angry. And as you approach me, I will feel your anger in my body, right? Because I will conformally apprehend you. But then I have a choice of how to react to your anger instantly. So I could react to your anger angrily, or I could react to your anger compassionately. That's my choice. I will experience your anger as anger. I will feel it as it was, but I can choose how to react to that anger. Yes?
Why are you saying that you'd experience it as it was as opposed to how it is?
Because whatever I experience is something that was already completed on your part. In other words, by the time I can register that you're angry, the actual occasion that was angry is already gone and you're having a new one. But I'm receiving the last one that you just had. Right? Because it takes time for the transmission of causal relations, the transmission of causal information in the universe.
How much time?
It happens, I believe, at the speed of light.
Pretty fast.
Yeah.
So if the anger's ongoing.
Well, yeah, I'll keep feeling it, right? But the point is, in general, it's like I'm just feeling you. But if we look at it really, really closely, my experience of you always happens some split second after your experience of you. So I'm always a little bit behind in my experience of you. And the reason that's important is because it means that in this very moment, I have freedom. At this very moment, all of you are having a causal impact on me. The past of what you were is having a causal impact on me, but in this present moment, I'm free. Because you're not causally affecting me in some sense as I make my decision. Right? I have a moment of privacy, a moment of individuality, an instant of individuality in which I make a free choice. And then my free choice becomes what you experience, and then you have a free moment, and then, right? So it's a reciprocal exchange that's going on, in which each one of us is experiencing the other a split second ago.
Okay, what about anticipating or intuiting future responses or something else?
Well, there are a lot of ways to talk about that. Anticipating or intuiting, first of all, is certainly a lot of anticipating or intuiting is induction. In other words, if I've seen you behave in a certain way a whole bunch of times, I'm going to assume you're going to behave that way again, unless for some reason not to. So that kind of prediction is clear and obvious. But it may be that if I am paying a lot of attention to you, and so I am feeling you in a very intimate way, I may feel how you a split second ago are already thinking about what you're going to do 2 seconds from now, and I might pick that up from you and know it before it happens. Right? Because I can feel your intention to do something in the next minute, even before you've done it. That make sense?
Almost.
Could I ask you a question?
Okay, so I thought that you can only get information from expired actual occasions and their outcome, but it sounds to me like you're implying that you can get information from her thought process from within the actual occasion.
Because that is part of the actual occasion, and the whole actual occasion is what's objectified, not just the outer part. Every emotion, every subjective form, every thought that's involved in your presence is part of the way you objectify, right? And so, you know, it's like there's a spectrum of objectification. So certain things like the chairs and the carpet in this room, I objectify in a very distant way. I don't identify with them. Right? I don't feel the inside of them very much. But with you guys, I feel you in a much richer way. And I feel you, so it's like, I don't know if we've done this exercise here before. Have we done the exercise with different grades of feeling? I guess not. Okay, so pick up an inorganic object, a pen or a book or something. Right? And then notice what it feels like to hold it. So notice if you try to really focus on it and feel what it feels like on the inside, it's really hard to do that. We have very little empathy with inorganic things. They objectify very abstractly for us. Okay?
It's also different whether the There is also the difference whether the inorganic things are natural or that's just artificial. Because if they
we can get that, but I want to go there right now. I want to make a cruder distinction. Hmm. So now imagine holding a puppy instead of a pen. Right? Notice how your whole body changes. And notice how when you pick up the puppy, there's a certain sense of transparency. Teilhard would call it radial communication. Like when you pick up the puppy, you feel its timidity and its joy and its love, right? It's like there's this heart opening that happens when you pick it up, right? And so you're objectifying the puppy much more fully than you're objectifying the inorganic object. And it might be different with natural objects like rocks, but also have a subtle difference from manufactured objects. But then imagine holding your lover, right? And then, again, the feeling of identification grows. Right? So as you're dealing with actual occasions of graves that are closer to your own, you can enter into deeper and deeper rapport. And it's possible, as psychics know, that this rapport can reach the point where it approximates identity. We actually feel like you are that person. And many of us have probably had the experience in sex where it's like it becomes one body having sex, right? Because the boundary between the two bodies just becomes insignificant. There's such an identification, such a concrete objectification back and forth that it becomes almost like one consciousness. Right? So there's this spectrum of objectification. And I forgot why I was trying to your question, Linda. It's your question.
Shannon.
What was the question?
Shannon.
What was your question, Shannon? Am I still talking about your question?
I was talking about just the temporal relationship.
I'm talking about these degrees of relationship approaching identity. And I had a reason for that.
Different grades of it, experiencing different grades of occasions. That's what
Okay, so anyway, I forgot where I was going with it. So we have these different grades and we experience them differently. I know I was responding to something, but I forgot.
The fact that you can get intention and thought from the inside of an object.
That's right. So in fact, you see that we can move into a level of empathic and telepathic rapport which approaches identity. Right? And we can feel what the people around us are feeling. I mean, you know, as a psychotherapist, this is my stock and trade. You know, I sit there and I feel what my clients are feeling, and then I tell them what they're feeling, and that helps them work with it, right? Because I get the direct information about their inner experience. That's how actual occasions causally interact with each other, is by sharing experience. Remember, in the modern world, the primary image of a causal interaction is that of a billiards ball striking another billiard ball. It's an external relationship. But the primary model of causality in a process universe is the way my past moment of consciousness causes my current moment of consciousness. And I know very intimately what I was thinking and feeling a split second ago. It floods into me as if it's still me. That's the kind of causal interaction that's taken as normative in a world of actual occasions. Right? So in the modern world, we think, those inorganic things out there that are purely vacuous and abstract are doing their dance. And somehow I'm trying to account for psychokinesis and empathy and telepathy, and it's all impossible to account for. But if every actual occasion has consciousness and purpose and interiority and decision, and if the way actual occasions causally interact with each other is by re-experiencing past experience, then empathy and telepathy become absolutely normative ways of causal interaction. Then we have to explain how come very low-grade occasions act as if they don't have empathy and telepathy. But we don't have to explain empathy and telepathy on the basis of these very primitive interactions that can't possibly scale up. You see? So every actual occasion objectifies itself not by its outer appearance. Every actual occasion objectifies itself as an experience of the universe which others can re-experience. Okay? It's a very, very different view. It's very challenging to try to feel your way into this universe.
It's a very living universe. It's very different from the universe of science. Okay, so we experience the past conformally, and then, as I've been saying, mind is intrinsic to matter. We've now seen that. And since mind is intrinsic to matter, and since matter can function more or less mentally, we have a way of establishing different grades of actual occasions. And as we'll see, the idea of different grades of actual occasion is the way we handle what the theosophist handled by subtlety and higher frequency. Causality is a transmission of experience. Creativity is built into the fabric of existence. That is, everything is a fresh creation. Between the past and the future comes a conscious decision. Creative advance is guided by purpose. Okay. So these are the main points that I was trying to make. So the world is there. Some actual occasion expired and it left behind it an actual world. Let's say the actual occasion that was me, I think, a second ago has just expired and we freeze the situation, which only abstractly, right? So here I am about to have a new moment. There's the universe. God, or the ultimate ordering factor, decides where the next actual occasion will be that will conquest that universe and what grade it will have. And if I'm lucky enough that God decides he wants to put an actual occasion where I can, in effect, pour myself into it, right, then I'll continue in time. So if that happens, then a new me comes into being. A new potential Eric comes into being. But the new potential Eric is kind of a blank slate. It has an aim. It has a purpose of existing in a way that will enrich the value of the universe. And it has an aim that I will inherit from my past society and so forth, right? And then it will take in the universe and say, ah, now this is the universe, right? And then I interpret that universe. And as I interpret that universe, one of the things that I make use of very strongly is all the ways I interpreted the universe a split second ago. So they pour in. It makes it really easy. I'm just sort of now, I'm not really attending to everything. I'm attending to what's different from what it was a minute ago, right? And so I take everything in, I elaborate an interpretation of what's going on, I say, okay, there it is, there's the world. Given the world, here are the things that I might do next. And then I choose one. And that's the cycle of concrescence, right? Take in the world, interpret it, elaborate the possibilities and make a decision, and then start all over. That's creativity. And through the process of creativity, we have cosmogenesis. Right? So we have all these actual occasions coming into being, taking each other in, interpreting, making decisions, making something of themselves for the future, and then expiring into objective immortality. Right? So that the process of actuality, the process of cosmogenesis, is an ongoing process of feeling, interpreting, and choosing over and over again, all carried out in the environment of a field of structured possibilities that is with all actuality. And so this is the vision of the cosmos that we're talking about. Very, very different from the modern vision of the cosmos. Totally pervaded by empathy and telepathy and psychokinesis and establishing the possibility for life after death. And it's like this, if we look at the universe this way, it opens up in a way completely different from the way it does if we look at it in terms of modern categories of thought. Yes? Rebecca?
Yeah. So how does Gebser's idea of the rotation of consciousness fit in with this, where it's not necessarily causally predetermined? Yeah, the next mutation?
Good question. So for one thing, I would like to imagine, although I haven't been able to do this yet, that we could, you know, each actual occasion has the world it takes in, and then it constructs an appearance of that world for itself as it interprets the world. In the different mutations, the interpretation is built differently. So I'm hoping that we can say,
we can understand the mutations as rearrangements of the process of concrescence. But I haven't worked it out in detail. I'm hoping we can do that. Right? And so that would mean that we could then use Whitehead's ideas to give a metaphysical accounting of the mutations of consciousness. I'm not sure that's going to work, because it may turn out that the idea of actual occasions is so wedded to the mental mutation that I'm not going to be able to generalize it back. I haven't figured that out yet. This is one of my current questions. I thought I figured it out all the way back, and now I realize that Whitehead's conception of actual occasions may be too mental to bring it all the way back. It may need to be rethought in some way. I'm working on that. I don't know.
So
does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Great. Good.
So we're wanting to figure out what an archaic experience is, then.
Yeah, what is an archaic?
In other words, it's subjectified.
Right, so I do think, as I've said, that in a certain way, the notion of actual occasions is transparent to the earlier mutations. Because an actual occasion is a synchronicity, and therefore it is a magical event. And because an actual occasion is a person, at least it's a proto-person, and so it's open to the mythical, and there are logical relations among actual occasions, which is mental. And so we may be able to do this, right? But the way Whitehead describes the process of concrescence in terms of causal prehension, conceptual prehensions, and propositions is so mental that I'm not sure we can construct a model of the mythic understanding. I haven't figured this out. This is all, like, I thought I had it knocked, and now it's all opening up for me again. Right? It's like, you know, I really thought I had figured out how Whitehead could encompass Gebser's mutations, and now I'm not sure that I had it right. So that's one of the horizons up.
Are there four parts to the concrescence function?
That correspond to the mutations, you mean? Not really. Zayn, what's Zayn's last name?
Newman.
Zayn Newman has been studying this, and he has this idea that he can map the different mutations to different phases of concrescence.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm thinking.
Right. And so this has to do with, like, the phases of, like, you know, simple feelings. No, it's more like simple feelings, propositional feelings, intellectual feelings.
Oh, I see.
Which have to do with the later stages of concrescence.
Just the actual concrescence part of the theory.
So basically what Zayn's suggesting is that the different mutations represent higher grades of occasions. Right? Because it's a more complex process. Hmm. Now, I can see that his idea has a lot of merit. And there are passages in Whitehead that really seem to work for his usage of it. But I have my doubts about whether it'll be a final theory or not that'll work. But it's one way to look at it.
Doesn't form seem to correspond to the mental?
No.
Not that easy?
Not at all. No. It's not that easy. Because there's form at every level. I mean, at the mythic level, there's certainly form. There are archetypal forms and personal forms, right? And so,
well, you wouldn't say that during, like, the mythic, the mental's not taking place.
Obviously not. It is taking place.
It's just not perceived.
It's not prominent. It's sort of pre-conscious or unconscious, right? I mean,
yeah, because there's occasions that are happening always.
Yeah. Well, listen, I don't know how to do this. So one possibility would be to look at the different elements, like form and stuff. I don't think that'll help you very much. I don't see the possibility yet, although you may be seeing something I don't. Another way is Zayn's way. And I've got a third way that I'm trying to cook up, but I haven't got it well enough cooked up to really express it yet. So this is interesting. What you just raised is a fascinating topic. It's going to be Zayn's dissertation. And I think there's room for a lot of dissertations on this. That is, how do we form an ontological accounting of the mutations of consciousness? So the question is the idea of actual occasions and concrescence sufficiently rich that we can develop it into a theory of mutations? And what would we have to do that? Right? So this is a topic I'd love to supervise somebody on a dissertation if you're interested, because it's fascinating and unknown how it's going to come out, what's going to be the best way to do that. And it can have a lot of implications.
The implication I'm curious about is if we can't situate the mental in the archaic, then that means we can't use our minds to do metaphysics, which I don't believe
we can't situate our mind in the archaic.
If we can't find an archaic form of the mental, if objectification doesn't somehow make sense to us in an archaic world.
Well, it may be that it's possible to have a non-objectified experience of the world. I think that the possibility of a completely aperspectival view is important. And because certainly a lot of Eastern thought implies this, and I think Gebser may imply that there is a mode of experience which is prior to the division into subject and object.
He does talk about unperspectival.
Yeah, and exactly. But see, I don't know exactly what he means, because it's clear he's talking about a way. When he says unperspectival or aperspectival, for sure.
Well, that's the integral.
That's the integral.
Yeah.
And then the unperspectival, right? It'd be pre-the-mental. He does use that statement.
Yeah, I think the magical is unperspectival and the mythical is pre-perspectival, but I'm not sure.
I'm not even sure. I don't remember exactly.
Is the archaic like syllogism? Is
it? No.
It's not. Where you just think you're just experiencing.
Absolutely not. No. It's more like non-dual awareness.
Yes.
It's like non-dual awareness. It's like, I think non-dual awareness begins to approach that component of the integral experience through which all the other structures become transparent. If there is some lucid participation in the primal ground that precedes the division into subject and object, then all those divisions become transparent. And so it must be the case. Like I said, I didn't do that this time, but we could, if we have time later, speak about Sri Aurobindo's model for how every actual occasion emerges out of the unconditioned pre-subject-object ground. And that's a very interesting study. And by the way, I've worked it all out on paper. It's on my website. And it's a piece called something like The Involution. The word The Involution is part of the title. Sri Aurobindo's Metaphysics, The Involution or something. It's on my website, and I've worked out in quite a bit of detail how one model for how actual occasions can emerge out of a primal ground, which is not yet differentiated into subject and object.
Is that what you mean by, how do you mean becoming transparent?
Well, you see, we tend to operate in one mutation or another most of the time. And our society, as sort of an official policy, tends to privilege the rational construing of reality, the objectification of reality. And we forget. So we think the universe is really made of atoms. But we forget that's just one way of seeing the universe that floats on the mythic, that floats on the magic, that floats on the archaic. We forget that, and we act as if the mental mutation is the way it really is. Just like fundamentalists think their idea is what really is, and scientists think it's what it really is, right? So transparency is very close to sense of humor. Right? It means like, hey, that's interesting, we can divide the world that way. Cool, let's use that, but let's not get too caught up in it, because you can also divide the world this way and that way, and they're all happening simultaneously, and that's the quality of transparency. But we seek for security in the reification of our mutation. Right? So if we can say, okay, we don't have to worry anymore. Now we've secured three-dimensional space. Now we know the truth. Right? Now we know what the universe is really made of, right? We feel safe and secure. Right? But of course, it's not true, right? It's actually just one way of interpreting it through the deficient mental mutation of consciousness. And we have to let go of that and realize it's just one interpretation. But it's scary to do that, right? Because it's groundless, right? And so we need to get some sort of comfort in the groundlessness in order to achieve transparency. Because it isn't really any one of those ways. And the way it really is, we can't express. And yet, we are the way it really is, so we know it. And it gets very paradoxical.
And that the transparency is involved in that kind of paradoxical situation, where it is but isn't what's real.
Does Getzer talk about personalities being lending themselves more towards one mutation than another, so you might be trapped in a mental mutation,
yes,
more of a mythic type of person?
Well, you might be trapped in the mythic if you're a mythic, or trapped in the mental, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, he's one of his polemics, one of his ongoing polemics is against illegitimate regression. He says that, for example, when people say, all is one, it's a regression to a deficient magical perspective. Right? Because it collapses the insight into diversity and forgets it, so it regresses to a magical understanding. Right? Mm. Or if we say, you know, everything is God and the whole universe is a moral drama, like some of the fundamentalist Christians say, well, then you're deficient mythic because you're excluding the mental. You're sort of throwing it away while you're making this statement. So you can't go back into an earlier mutation and ignore what's happened since. You have to go forward and integrate the mutations and their accomplishments in some higher synthesis, or signoresis, as Gebser would say.
Is the ever-present origin the same idea or similar to the primordial mind, ultimate ordering in Gebser?
No.
That's how I interpret it.
Wait, let me think about that again. Say it again.
The notion of the ever-present origin.
No, the ever-present origin is more like, if anything, it's much more like creativity than it is like anything else in Whitehead's system. Okay. Right? It's that which churns up actuality. And so it's probably a little bit like creativity, except that for Gebser, the ever-present origin probably includes all the eternal objects in it, whereas for Whitehead it doesn't. So for Whitehead, creativity is an abstraction. Right? He says, okay, we have eternal objects. Now, what makes the whole thing go? That's creativity, right? And so it's this abstract process of many becoming one and being increased by one. It's sort of isolated out of the whole system. But for Whitehead and for, I believe, for Gebser, the origin is not just the factor of activity, but it also includes all the eternal objects in it. And so it's an actual creator. And so in some sense, the ultimate Graham chooses a set of eternal objects which will characterize the universe. So if, for example, as Whitehead at one stage of his thinking says, God establishes among all the many possible geometries one geometry that will be for our universe, more or less. And then everything that's real henceforth in this universe fits into that geometry. So God has within God's self all these geometries, and then God decides from within God's self which one will become the framework for this new creative activity. Right? So that the creative source includes the possibility. It's a concrete actuality. It's Satchidananda, right? It's got consciousness and value and eternal objects and creativity all built into it. Whereas for Whitehead, creativity is sort of an abstract slice of all that. So Whitehead's creativity is not really a full creator in the sense that God would be for Aurobindo or the ever-present origin would be for Gebser. This is a different logical analysis.
Okay, yeah. I don't really understand the Whitehead thing, but I'll work on it.
Yeah. The Whitehead thing is hard to understand because it isn't very satisfying. So, we can talk about that later. Okay, well, that's the lecture I wanted to give today. So I really wanted to make this point about possibility and actuality, and the eternal objects and the events and the difference between them, and the process of actualization, through which consciousness gives reality character by deciding what character it should have. So this is a very, very different universe, the universe of science, in which the atoms already have character, and all they do is combine and recombine. This is a much more active, dynamic universe. It's processed all the way down. It's got purpose and creativity all the way down. It's got life all the way down. And yet, it can still behave as inorganic occasions, exactly the way physicists want them to do. Right? So we now have a much larger conceptual system from which physics is an abstraction. And therefore, physics is completely justified in all of its details. And one of the most important functions of any metaphysical system at the beginning of the 21st century is to say why science works. Otherwise, you're not doing anything, right? Because science does work. And if you can't account for the workings of science, your philosophy is no good at this particular time. Right? So here we have a method of understanding actuality, which resolves the mind-body problem, puts mind back into nature fundamentally, allows us to fully explain how, why physicists get the results they do, why mathematics is relevant to the description of actuality when it is, and creates all this room for now for the expression and exploration of the transphysical worlds as well. Right, so we put science on a footing now, which makes it adequate to the transphysical. Now, in the next week, we're going to start talking about causality and how causality works in the realm of actual occasions. And then chapter 6 is going to be the hardest chapter of all. It's very technical, and it deals with the details of the process of concrescence. So I'd like to ask you for next week to read chapter 5, which is pretty short, and to start chapter 6, and maybe even if you can, read it through once. Because you have to read it through and then read it. You can't expect to get it all in the first reading. It's dense. After that, after we get through chapter 6, it's free sailing after that, and it starts to get really fun. So I want to tell you that. Okay, and then we're going to see the payoff starting when we get to chapter 7 of this whole thing. Okay, so now we can have time for discussion, and I'm happy to discuss whatever's on your mind, and however you want to ramify these ideas. Let's try an experiment. We're wanting to try a free write, like Elizabeth keeps asking me to do. So let's experiment with that. I think it's a really interesting idea. So my invitation to you is take out a piece of paper, and for the next 8 minutes, let's say, just write. And you can write anything you want, but it'd be nice if you made your writing relevant to the ideas we're discussing today. But just give yourself a chance to process what we've done this morning, the last couple hours, and think about it, and then see what kind of questions come up. So I just want to give you a chance to digest and process and write. Let's say for the next 8 minutes, okay? And then we'll have our discussion. So you're looking for things to discuss in this process. A process that you'd like to share, either as a statement or as a question. Yes.
I guess my fear is that I don't know if anybody else is even interested in this concept, so that's why I haven't brought it up, but I'm having a hard time reconciling the idea of, you know, actual occasions with the physiology that's happening in our bodies. I guess in a way of, you know, you talk about empathy as being this way of being. But in my head, I keep going back to, okay, well, physiologically, I also at the same time believe that empathy is a process of our limbic system, mm-hmm. and that we're experiencing that. So I'm having a hard time reconciling how they tie in together.
Yeah, that is a very good question. So you're coming from two very different contexts of thought.
Right. I'm trying to...
Yeah, so let's see. So one of the contexts of thought is the idea that, let's say, the emotions that we feel, or like empathy even, is a function of our bodies, is a function of some particular organ system in the body, right? I'm suggesting something quite different. I'm suggesting that the universe consists of actual occasions, and that actual occasions are empathic with each other at this very deep level. Now, so if you think that the limbic system, let's say, is responsible for compassion, you're implying that the universe by itself is not compassionate, that it just operates according to these abstract causal laws, and it's only if the molecules, which are insentient, manage to put themselves together in some peculiar combination we call the limbic system, that the experience of compassion is possible. Right? So this is the modern way of thinking it. Right? I'm saying that if, in fact,
the components of our body are insentient. No combination of them could ever lead to empathy, period. Right? In other words, how many tinker toys does it take to create an empathic system? Right? That's what you're saying, right? So, I'm saying, if we assume that the world is initially vacuous or automatic or dead, then no combination of dead things will ever feel empathy for anything. If, however, we assume that the world is made of actual occasions, and we assume that causal transmission is the transmission of experience, then empathy and causality can't even be separated from each other, because every causal interaction involves empathy. Now, then the body may have some way of bringing together the limbic system in such a way that it focuses higher grade occasions, which are more fully empathic, and so it may focus the natural empathy that's already there. But if actual occasions couldn't feel empathy for each other, then nothing could ever feel empathy for anything. So we have to build it in all the way at the beginning. Otherwise, we can't ever pull it out at the end.
That makes sense. I think that's where I'm struggling, is thinking that actually the body maybe created this process so that we could experience an actual occasion or something similar.
Right, but when you say the body, then what do you mean?
Right.
Right, do you mean a collection of dead atoms?
Right.
In that case, I don't see how any combination of dead atoms could produce a living being. Yeah. But if every atom is an actual occasion, which is already purposeful and conscious and value-laden and decisive, then we can, and if there are actual occasions of different grades, then we can see how the body gets built up, right? Because it's all living, it's all communicating with each other. The body is, in effect, an empathic ocean, right? It's like a, let's take that back, an empathic puddle, right? So inside my body, there's a complete field of empathy. So that if I've got a hangnail, my whole body is miserable through the empathy with my toe, right? It's all empathic in here, and so the way I'm imagining it is that the inside of the body is like a little bubble of the astral world surrounded by the inorganic ocean, right? But what it's like inside our body is what it's like on the transphysical worlds if we're actually able to leave our body and go there. It's all empathy.
Why do you need a limbic system then, or why is that particularly associated with...
I don't exactly know how that works, but I would say this. I mean, I haven't thought through that. But I mean, for example, we have eyes, sort of like an limbic system, right? And so,
yeah.
Right? And so the point is that we our personalities are very high grade, and very high grade personalities have a very hard time relating to very low grade personalities. Like, it's really hard for us to be empathic with inorganic matter. We can do so, and that's what psychokinesis is about. I just finished writing a whole chapter on that, right? How we at high grade actual occasions can focus our attention on low-grade actual occasions and animate them the way a cellular consciousness does. Okay, so...
why do we need eyeballs to see?
Yeah, so what happens is that if my mental occasion, my high-grade occasion, confronted the physical world head-on, it would just be a big blank. I couldn't quite relate to it, right? So the lower-grade actual occasions, they relate to the molecules. And then slightly higher grade occasions form into a nervous system and so forth, right? And so my body becomes a way of translating the experience of the physical world in such a way that a high grade occasion can work with it. Yeah.
I will read you something about what I think.
Excellent.
In this class, it may not make sense to you, but what I would just read what I put. I am a child of tradition. I bring the past always to the present. In order to understand the very moment of my being, that is what events and circumstances placed me in this class among the fellow classmates. I started my life from a village on the other side of the world, Afghanistan, at the sunset of feudal era, that's 1200. And now I am living in the postmodern era, otherwise from myth consciousness
mythic, yeah,
to the mental consciousness, 2011.
Wow. That's amazing.
That's what the whole class, I think, that's how we look the world. What events and conditions put us on the road of so-called our destiny, or what we are, as we come. Mm-hmm. Unless I bring that tradition, my actual occasion of the past now, it would be hard for me to understand about 400, 500, or 800 years.
That's right. That's beautiful. And you know, I'm really glad you said that, because it really highlights for all of us where we are in time. I mean, you've had this incredibly compressed experience of the mutations in one lifetime, which is an amazing experience, right? But all of us, in some sense, have gone through that, at least in through our childhood development and so forth. We've all sort of been through that. And here we are. And it is simply impossible to overstate the incredible significance of this moment in history. You just can't overstate it. But this is the end of the Cenozoic era, right now. Right? And we are clearly living through the end of industrial civilization. I mean, the shit has hit the fan. Right? It happened already. Right? It's already disintegrating all around us. There's no going back. Right? We're in the disintegration. I've been waiting for this all my life. And here it is. It's kind of an amazing thing, right? So now we're looking into a very, very blank future. I have no clue. I've got my ideas about the transphysical technology and the integral era, right? And it's the best I've been able to put up with after thinking about this for the last 15 years, right? And so, hey, I don't know. I just got this idea I put together, right? Because I've been thinking about it for so long. But the future is not known right now. And what's not, so I was reading Sri Aurobindo, Synthesis of Yoga, last night. Tuesday night, and it's very beautiful. I can't recommend the beginning of that book enough. And he's talking about the evolution of spiritual disciplines. It's very fascinating. And he talks about how the modern world is a cauldron of Medea, in which every idea and every project and every discipline is just being thrown in there, and it's being cooked and sliced and diced and mixed with everything else, and it's just this big cauldron, and we're not sure what's going to emerge out of it. Right? And so his question at the beginning of that book is there a way to reach back into the roots of the inspiration of Indian yoga so as to make it relevant to the integral mutation? And that whole book, you know, 700-page book, that's what he's doing. He's trying to see if he can recast yoga so it becomes a viable project in the integral era. It's an amazing project, right? But the same project, we have to recast both science and philosophy so that they can have a purpose and a function in the integral mutation. Or they may simply die if we can't reconfigure them. Right? And so we're all here at this moment, right? And we're trying to figure out not just how to make sense out of things, but what are the projects of understanding? Right? Because an integral philosophy is something that's probably 5 or 6 generations away from where we are. Right? So we're sort of not only articulating philosophies, we're articulating philosophical projects. We're articulating new disciplines. Right? So we're just at such a fundamental level of rethinking. It couldn't get any more radical. Right? The mental world has really disintegrated. It disintegrated already in 1900. It disintegrated. It really was already dead by the beginning of the 1800s when they discovered non-Euclidean geometry, which just wiped out the mental universe, as far as I can tell. And here we are in this incredible open ground, and we're feeling. What I got the other day is that we're not just feeling for answers; we're feeling for whole disciplines, right? That could mobilize generations of researchers. This is the level we're at right now. I'm just trying to create directions, new forms of knowledge. What will the form of knowledge look like in the integral? Yeah, it's just, these are really profound questions. Yeah, Shannon.
Go back to Becky's question and Heather and Sue, your impassioned moment there about, you know, I come from a pretty atheistic hard science evolutionary background, and I'm still, I don't want to give up effective dialogue with, I mean, some of my mentors that I'm still in touch with identify as atheists. And so in terms of her question, and from an evolutionary standpoint, or a Darwinian standpoint, empathy evolved because it was adaptive. It all comes down to what's adaptive for life, mm-hmm. perpetuated.
That's Darwinian. That's a Darwinian approach. That's right.
Yeah. So I really appreciated your point that even that actually could be true alongside what you're saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That empathy, and I'm not going to do what you said justice probably, but like for empathy to ever exist in even in this kind of, you know, materialistic reductionistic reality that scientists are, you know, perpetuating. Like it had to have preceded.
That's right. You got it.
I got it.
You got it.
Okay,
see,
now how do we translate that to the haters?
Well, here's what I'm saying. Basically, I would say to them, you know, you guys have got it really well up to a point, right? Because in fact, the universe, we can legitimately say that the universe is made up of simpler components. And in fact, among those simple components, in process philosophy, we can find atoms and we can find subatomic particles. And so we agree with you scientists, hey, you guys are on the right track. The only thing is this, we think that in your description of the scientific objects, you've been too abstract. So there really are atoms. But the thing is, an atom is actually a personally ordered society of actual occasions. And each actual occasion in that society has some tiny measure of intellect and some tiny measure of consciousness. And when it's causally affected by things, it's empathizing with them in a very, very crude, simple way. And so you're right. All the equations apply. These actual occasions are so simple that we can act as if they're mathematically determined. Except they aren't mathematically determined as we know, because we know that the universe is not a deterministic system. There's quantum indeterminacy in it. And so what we're saying is, we like everything you scientists have said. It's all true. And now we're saying that in order to account for the indeterminacy, we're going to make your subatomic events into actual occasions. They look just like you say they do. Your experiments reveal just the results they do, no problem. But they're actually actual occasions. And so they're actually feeling the world, interpreting and deciding. And so therefore, these units that you scientists have identified really are the ultimate units, but they're more than you think they are. Right? So in this way, we preserve the whole scientific way of thought. That's why I love this. But the units that we're reducing it to turn out to be more concrete than the scientists realized they were. They went a little bit too far in the process of abstraction. Right? So the abstractions are valid in the way they're used, but it's too abstract to account for evolutionary emergence.
Or to account for meaning.
Yeah, or to account for meaning of any kind whatsoever, or experience itself. Or value, right?
Because the answer is always it's adaptive. Empathy evolved because it's adaptive to the species. But where
why?
Did it
come? That's it.
Why is it adaptive?
That's
where
it.
Did it come
well,
from originally?
Exactly.
And what for?
And but particularly that one question I want to focus on. They're all important questions, but where did it come from? That's the one I want to focus on in this
what's
moment.
What's the origin?
What's the origin?
If it's all reducible to dead matter.
That's right.
I mean,
then if it's all reducible to dead matter, then how could life ever come out of it? How many tinker toys does it take to make a cell, right? Exactly, right? So, but if every tinker toy is made of actual occasions, lo and behold, it might become a cell. You see? Right? And so that's the difference here. So the reason I love Whitehead so much is because he allows me to preserve the value of scientific thinking. Right. Scientific thinking is valuable because it objectifies the world as a system of causally interacting events. That's beautiful. I think that's a valid way of looking at the world as a system of causally interacting events. I'm just saying that each event is a quantum of experience. And so it comes to have the character it does. Each subatomic occasion comes to have the particular character it does because it decides on that character from among the possibilities that appear in the probability matrix. It doesn't interrupt quantum mechanics at all. Completely consistent with quantum mechanics, completely consistent with relativity. It explains those scientific facts in a way that classical science can't, and it allows the reintegration of mind into the natural world, and it accounts for evolutionary emergence, and it accounts for parapsychology, and it accounts for life after death and the possibility of enlightenment, all without sacrificing any scientific accomplishments at all. That's why I like it. Make sense? Mm-hmm. Yes, Bill.
So, of course, as a neuroscientist, I'm struggling with all this also. And I think what really interests me is there's, I think it's similar to what you're saying, but evolution and so forth expresses fundamental possibilities in the mind of God and so forth. And so to get higher grade occasions and so forth, that's what all this process is about. And what really interests me is how science has all this awesome detail of things viewed from the outside with not any appreciation of the grades and so forth. So how, my interest is how to fuse the scientific neuroscience knowledge with this view that there's interiority to everything there,
right,
and see if it's possible to see how the evolutionary process and so forth and the structures developed produced grades, and how, if you know something about it, how interiority has developed and expressed itself through brain structure as a living, scintillating set of occasions, how can we develop, can we get, extending science that way, can we get further insights that will help us do spiritual practice and yeah, stuff like that?
Great. That's the project. That's just beautiful. Yeah.
Science isn't going to be happy to stop at just describing the actual occasions in this physical way. It's going to want to go in and discuss the interiority and
absolutely,
consciousness, which is what we're doing here. This is science actually trying to go into the other side.
That's exactly right. We're trying to bring scientific attitudes into the exploration of the psyche and the transphysical worlds.
This is in a sense more of a scientific class wanting to explore,
that's right,
the non-physical, and say, no, we're not limited to studying the physical world of science. Matter of fact, that's not enough.
That's it.
We have to go further with science.
You got it.
It's not
that's
withholding
it.
Science back from saying, oh, no, you can't come here and discuss these spiritual themes with your science. That's only for out there in those experiences in the world. It's like,
that's right. This is a complete reformulation of science. And it does it, and it accomplishes the reformulation by leaving intact most of the explanatory methods of science, but shifting the content of what's being explored. Right? So it says, instead of exploring insentient, dead energy and atoms, we're exploring the world of actual occasions.
And the reason why it's insentient and dead is just one, we just lost one little idea that got twisted, and that's where we arrived. And if we can go back and untwist that,
that's it,
we arrive somewhere else.
That's right. Beautiful. Yeah.
I really agree with that, and I didn't ask about doing my presentation because it felt
like
it wasn't a fit. And we can do it next week.
I really want to do it.
Putting it off, but I really agree with where you're coming from. I mean, we're sort of like a toehold of a new extension of science, but a big part of it relates to what I was going to talk about, which is part of the little twist that went the wrong way was trying to rip science out of its philosophical context.
That's right.
And so partly what we're trying to do is we're putting it back where it belongs in the philosophical matrix that allows it to grow in ways that have been stunted because it was ripped out from that.
That is huge.
Roots. And that's what positivism is. It's trying to rip science out from a metaphysical context and just look at what you can exactly measure and things like that.
Okay, so next time, we're going to start with your
perspective. Okay.
And don't let me forget, I got lost.
No, it looked like there wasn't time.
And no, there was plenty of time. I just got lost.
In what sense is an actual occasion of measurement? And when you say it's a quanta, is...
Well, there are two different senses of measurement that we have to be talking about here. One is the measurement in the classical sense. Measurement in the classical sense involves assigning a number to a process by comparing it to rulers and clocks. In quantum theory, measurement becomes something very different. It becomes simply detecting something.
Like Planck units.
Right? What?
Planck units.
Well, they're not Planck units, just detecting something, anything. Right? It just detects, like, you know, it detects a color or a spin or a mathematical property of some kind, right? And so in quantum theory, anything you can detect, particularly in an experiment, is a measurement. But it doesn't have to assign a number.
Yeah.
Right? So quantum measurements are more like yes or no questions.
Yeah.
Whereas classical measurements are actual number questions, right? So in the quantum sense, actual occasions are performing measurements, but not in the classic sense.
How are you dealing with modern science's obsession with observation?
Well, modern science claims to be empirical, but then it describes reality in a way that nobody's ever seen, right? And couldn't, right? And so it really isn't empirical at all. And the science I'm talking about really is empirical because I'm saying if we start with raw experience, how do we derive scientific objects out of raw experience? Well, this is really empirical. It's empirical on a deeper level. Then we can define scientific empiricism as an abstraction from real empiricism. Because scientific empiricism only credits the results of experiments and not the rest of raw experience. So it's a very limited form of empiricism. Okay, it's 2:45. This has been a great class. Thank you. Now, wait, before you leave, if you haven't turned in your paper, I prefer it by email. It's easier for me. So just email if you haven't given your paper yet, email it to me. I'd really prefer that. Preferably in something compatible with Microsoft Word. Okay? And next week, read Chapter 5 and try to read ahead in Chapter 6. It'll really help if you take a quick read through Chapter 6 and then go back and reread it next week. It'll really help you a lot. And this is the hardest, probably the hardest chapter. After that, I say it's clear sailing. Okay. Have a great week.
Thank you.